federal funds. Interviews with landlords and tenants paint a very grim portrait of a borough in distress, where the housing crisis is straining economic recovery. Some of those who did not receive or qualify for rent relief because they did not submit an application or did not meet the criteria may face eviction once the moratorium expires this January. Others will struggle for years to climb out of debt. Without rental income, property owners could let buildings slip into disrepair. "I'm very concerned about the long-term impact of such a momentous event," said Matthew Murphy, the executive director of the New York University Furman Center. Ever since she moved to New York City from Guayaquil in Ecuador 3 years ago, Livia Fernandez has worked as a cook. Since she lost her job, she has struggled to find work. She got COVID-19 again this March and has been unable to stand for long periods of time. "I can't find a full-time job because I feel physically weak," she says. She cannot afford food and sometimes gets help from a nearby church pantry. She's especially concerned for her daughters, Clara and Marta. "I can go hungry," she says, "but they can't. I do nails, I clean apartments, I do anything." She applied for the rent relief program when the landlord of her Mott Haven building pushed her, but she said she had not received any notice that her application was being considered. "I break down and start crying," she says, but then I control myself because who will take care of my daughters if I'm not around?" Her landlord, Inocencio Gonzalez, could not be reached for comment. Without a job, Livia Fernandez is anxious about the future. "Thank God my landlord hasn't been pushing or bothering with the rent money, but months keep passing by and my pressure has gone up a lot," she says. Mercedes Escoto, a 63-year-old, has not paid rent on her two-bedroom apartment in the High Bridge neighborhood of New York City since April of 2020. As of October, the sum of her unpaid bills, according to a letter she got from her landlord, was more than $43,000. In May of this year, the landlord filed court papers seeking her eviction. But like many renters facing eviction during the pandemic, her troubles had begun long before. 5 years ago, her landlord abruptly raised the monthly rent from around $1,400 to $2,000, she said. The rent would have claimed almost half of her income. Miss Scotto earns around $59,000 a year as a social worker and also takes care of her mother, who lives with her. "I told them from the get-go I could not pay all of that," she says. Unable to afford the increase, she fell behind on rent. She borrowed money from a city emergency assistance program and took roughly $11,000 out of her retirement account for back rent, money she is still paying back. The pandemic worsened Ms. Scotto's financial woes. Her mother got COVID-19 in March of 2020 and needs a walker, oxygen, and pain pills. Ms. Scotto had to take weeks off work without pay. She struggled with anxiety and depression. "I used to cry every day," she says. It was all too much for me." She also said she had a leaky bathroom ceiling and non-functional oven, emblematic of issues that are particularly prevalent in rent-stabilized buildings like hers. Unlike the city's other four boroughs, the Bronx has many more rent-stabilized units than unregulated apartments. She says that even if she could afford to pay back the rent, she is reluctant to do so until the repairs are made, especially as the moratorium on evictions has kept her case from moving forward. Mercedes Scotto has also applied for rent relief from the state. The landlord, a limited liability company associated with Isaac Casira, who has received national attention for pushing to gentrify affordable housing, filed papers last year seeking to deregulate the building so it can charge higher rents. In an email statement, Todd Rothenberg, a lawyer representing the landlord, said Ms. Scotto has not paid a single penny in 21 months. While the landlord has to pay me his property taxes, his mortgage, the heating, the hot water bill, etc., without any income whatsoever from Ms. Scotto. He noted that the landlord had agreed to charge Ms. Scotto a lower rent, around $1,500 a month, in October of 2020. It was not clear why she was still receiving bills reflecting a higher amount.
We get people.
The U.S. is still maintaining its broken immigration policy, even during the administration of Democratic President Joe Biden. In the previous administration, the left-wing-leaning media kept criticizing President Donald Trump for his crackdown on so-called illegal aliens, keeping children in cages, families separated, and trying to build a wall on the border with Mexico. Now, while the government is now safely distant from that media hype, not much has changed. Apprehending and removing undocumented immigrants who are considered a threat to national security and public safety of the U.S. continues unabated in a country claiming to be leader of the free world.
Immigration under Biden.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in this episode, we'll try to search for any end in sight on the issue of immigration, its victims and its enforcers, and broken policies creating the stalemate we are witnessing nowadays. My first guest in this episode will be journalist and author Daniel Lazar. And later on the show, I'll be joined by activist and commentator Don DeBar. Please stay with us as we delve into the ups and downs of the issue and do our best to shed light on how the situation could pan out for immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers in America.
Immigration has always been essential to America. Let's end our exhausting war over immigration. For more than 30 years, politicians have talked about immigration reform, and we've done nothing about it. It's time to fix it. On day one of my presidency, I kept my commitment and sent a comprehensive immigration bill to the United States Congress. If you believe we need to secure the border, pass it because it has a lot of money for high-tech border security. If you believe in a pathway to citizenship, pass it. It's over 11 million undocumented folks, the vast majority of here overstaying visas. Pass it. We can actually, if you actually want to solve a problem, I've sent a bill to take a close look at it.
Now, previously, we asked Mr. Lazar what he thinks the fact that migrants and refugee seekers' deaths at the U.S. southern border with Mexico has reached an all-time high. What exactly does that mean for Washington's continued claims of promoting human rights throughout the world?
Well, it certainly undercuts any U.S. claims to be enforcing human rights. The U.S. is pursuing extremely unjust policies with regard to immigration and internal economic development in the countries that are hardest hit in the Caribbean and in Central America, and the U.S. to a great extent is actually causing these problems that it now is wrestling with.
The U.S. southern border continues to be the epicenter of crackdown on asylum seekers and refugees. But their plight extends further into the country, where they continue to face harassment and fears of deportation. even those who have been on U.S. soil for generations and contributed to the country's well-being are not exempt from suffering.
There is no easy solution to migration because it's the interaction of different vulnerabilities, the violence, the lack of opportunities, you know, the vulnerability to natural disasters.
The Biden administration has not offered any practical shift in the U.S. anti-immigration policies and basically continues pushing the same policies regardless of the Democrats' full control over the country.
Earlier, we asked our guest Don DeBar that given the profound instability in some of the Caribbean and Latin nations, how he thinks the fate of the refugee seekers and migrants is going to pan out.
You know, the first thing is, you know, what's broken and what's fixed and how is it supposed to function? Essentially, the immigration into the United States and into the European Union, you know, also I assume into places like Japan and South Korea and Australia, places where there aren't wars being conducted right now and or death squads chasing people around, that those are magnets for people that are suffering the results of imperialism and U.S. foreign policy. People are being driven out of their homes because the conditions in their countries are intolerable as a direct consequence of colonial relations economically, imperial relations politically, and pretty much fascistic policies by the comprador governments that are placed in power by the U.S. and European colonial powers.
So hypocrisy prevails in U.S. politics as before, and the issue of immigration is no exception. Migrants keep being subjected to inhumane tactics, such as Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico program. Now, Joe Biden had vowed to compensate families of children separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border throughout the Trump administration, a pledge which remains to be materialized to this very day.
In balance, I would say that Trump's policies were maybe slightly worse, but the difference is really insignificant, and Biden has essentially pursued much the same policies. The problem is that the U.S. has devastated the Haitian economy. It has supported a coup d'etat. It has encouraged the growth of drug gangs due to its highly punitive approach to the war on drugs. And at the same time, it forbids Haitians to immigrate. Now, the U.S. has pursued some of the same policies in Puerto Rico, which is also located in the Caribbean.
The Democratic president also keeps pursuing the Trump policy known as Title 42, which continues to return migrants to an uncertain future in Mexico. Officially called the Migrant Protection Protocols, the program has so far sent over 70,000 people to unsafe cities near the U.S. border in Mexico. Given profound instability in some of the Caribbean and Latin nations, how is the fate of the refugee seekers and migrants going to pan out?
Biden sent 7,000 of them back to Haiti, where they originated. But Haiti is a devastated country where crime is through the roof. Criminal gangs control the countryside. And in fact, it's so bad that American diplomats are forbidden to leave the embassy grounds because doing so is simply too dangerous. So that actually surpasses anything that Trump did. It was a major crime against humanity.
Title 42 expulsions are just the tip of the iceberg in the U.S. crackdown on immigrants. In his first 6 months in office, Biden has exceedingly used that authority and even broken Trump's record in the quest to suppress immigrants at the southern border. The U.S. government boasted about payments of around $450,000 to compensate the brutal family separation practice. But now it has not only changed that figure, but also cast aspersions on whether it would be paid at all. We'll be right back.
Now, the crisis at the border is a telltale of the human rights situation in America. Putting kids in cages or so-called migrant facilities represents the depth of U.S. politicians' disregard for children who actually never chose to enter the country on their own. And the Trump administration was notorious for exercising zero tolerance at the U.S. border with Mexico. So what is the difference between the Trump administration and the current one in terms of dealing with migration at the southern border?
But primarily the media coverage. People are being sent back. You know, Obama was the great deporter. He actually sent back more people than Trump did by, I think, a factor of two or three, I forget. Not just because of his 8 years to 4 years, but actually in terms of, you know, per year. He sent more people back than Trump did. And Trump's numbers went down after securing the border in the first group under his administration, as opposed to the way it had been secured under Obama or Bush or Clinton.
The story of immigration into the United States has been laced with continuous reports of illegal crossings, detentions, and even murder and sexual abuse.
The situation facing people that leave a precarious situation in the Caribbean and Latin American countries are going to come to the United States and find also a precarious situation for themselves, with the exception of the compradors, the people that moved to Cuba, for example, after the Cuban Revolution, or the people that moved to Miami from Cuba, and the people that moved to Miami from Venezuela after 1998, the people that moved to Miami from Nicaragua, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those people do very well when they get here, or some of them do.
Now, whether or not they get in, most end up disillusioned at the conclusion of their journey. Life is certainly not pleasant for a large number of immigrants, no matter whether they enter the country legally or illegally, or those falling victim to gangs and cartels on the way. What do you personally think is next in the fight for immigrants' rights, and where do you see the U.S. government heading in dealing with this issue?
If there was some way to organically connect working people in the world, communicate directly with each other, and someone asked me this question knowing that, you know, it might be an input into the policy of people around the world, I would say first thing that has to happen is that workers in every place, whether they're in the United States or in Honduras or in Haiti or in Africa or in Belgium, have an interest that is distinct from that of the elite. None of us have an interest that identifies with the elite. And so where we find ourselves ignoring what the elite is doing to people in of the places I just mentioned, then we are already going to lose.
Republican politicians keep linking immigration into America to rising crime rates in the country. In fact, speaking about the issue, which is often laced with racism, is a talking point for the GOP officials to score political points ahead of the 2022 midterms and the 2024 presidential election. This is while U.S. imperialist policies have been touted as the main cause for Central Americans' struggle for decades, which has led to influx of migrants at the border.
They're claimed by one party over another to be concerned about the deaths of migrants and to be concerned about the lives of migrants. The lie is given to it by these statistics. These numbers have been pretty much constant, you know, within certain fractions on one side or the other, no matter if it were George Bush or Barack Obama or Donald Trump as president, regardless of all of the rhetoric that goes around the issue.
Now, the federal government in states such as Texas are meanwhile locked in fierce battles over the number of arrivals at the U.S.-Mexico border, by which southern states are immediately affected. How do you think the more progressive factions of the Democratic Party should react to the Biden administration's deportation of Haitians?
They should react not only by opposing deportations, but demanding comprehensive reform of U.S. economic policies, military policies, drug war policies, etc., in the Caribbean and in Central America. But they are not going to do that. They're just way too weak and way too narrowly focused to do anything like that. But that's what's needed, though.
Biden created a task force after taking office to address some of the brutal policies of the former presidents. Yet a whole lot of the pledges are still blowing in the wind. Trump administration's zero tolerance policy may have officially ended, but not much hope is in sight for families of migrants as the more sophisticated anti-immigration practices persist. Crossing the border illegally, meanwhile, remains the final solution for people escaping violence, poverty, and insecurity in certain countries of Central and Southern America.
Biden's policies are very bad. Biden represents a continuation of the policies of the last half century, which have had a devastating effect on the Caribbean, on Central America, et cetera. Not only has the U.S. supported dictators and coups, et cetera, but the U.S. economic policies have also had a devastating consequence. For example, Haitian agriculture has been destroyed by cheap U.S. imports, and Haiti essentially is not allowed to impose any kind of import restrictions due to intense pressure from U.S.-controlled agencies like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Hoping to reach a land where so-called human rights are promoted on a daily basis, refugees are confronted with an iron fist. So where do you think the American public stands about the Biden administration's handling of migration, given the fact that the nation was built by slaves and migrants in the first place?
Upon a genocide. First, they had to clear the land of the people that lived here. And then they had immigrants come. Some were induced or enticed into coming in one way or another, and others were just captured and dragged over here in chains. There's no question about the moral basis of opposition to immigration being, bad. There's no moral basis for it. Certainly no moral basis for anyone in the United States outside of the people who are indigenous to this continent. It's a more complex problem than just saying that, this group is right for saying immigrants should have free, access in and out of the country, and this group is wrong for saying that they shouldn't, because what in fact has happened is that you've had an attack on the people outside of the country in various nations, Central and South America we're talking about here, primarily in the Caribbean, but this has been going on in Africa and Asia as well. And
the issue of immigration, like many other issues, has been extremely politicized. Trump once said that he proudly gave secure borders to Biden despite the current situation. He even suggested that he created a smooth-running system on autopilot at the border, which Biden has now broken.
Well, I see the U.S. government heading towards more and more repressive measures and doing nothing, absolutely nothing, to reform its economic, military, and drug war policies in the Caribbean and Central America. I see absolutely nothing happening there. I only see a worsening, in fact. And so, therefore, that means there will be more human suffering, more desperate people on the Texas border fighting to get in, more kids abandoned, just more human horror stories.
Trump's anti-immigration policy was a centerpiece of his 2016 election campaign and is now a major issue as he seeks re-election in 2024. On the other hand, the current presidents appear to have been designed to keep both camps happy. But what about the rights of actual humans amassing at the border? No one really seems to care.
From now on, we have a new segment in our program titled Power to the People, by Abbas Montarem, first part.
Peace, what's going on? My name is Abbas Montarem, and I'm super excited to introduce this new segment of the show called Power to the People. On Power to the People, we're going to be examining the racism that is ingrained throughout this country, right? And if we want to fully understand racism, we have to understand the vehicle that racism has been driven through is settler colonialism, right? So on this episode, we're going to get a full understanding as best as we can in the next few minutes of what settler colonialism is as an ideology, as a practice, as a colonial practice of domination, subjugation that enacts genocide against indigenous peoples as well as African peoples, right? So the foundation of this country is a settler colony, meaning a foreign people, right? A foreign people from the land, people that the land has no right to, came. In this case, the Europeans came from all over Europe, came to America, enacted genocide on the indigenous people, stole their land, brought with them diseases, rape, pillage, some of the most inhumane crimes against humanity is what the Europeans did to America, right? This is why we call them Euro-Americans, because they are Europeans who came and created America, which has no legal or human right to exist based off of genocide, right? Because this is what it is. It's a genocidal country that was founded through the most terroristic acts against humanity. Through settler colonialism, the Europeans stole the land from the indigenous people. And also, they stole Africans. They stole us. They stole our people, right? They stole our people from the continent, our ancestral homeland, and forced us to come to the South. Forced us as slaves to come to the South. And it's very important to note that African peoples, we have been resisting ever since the first European came to the continent. Ever since the first European came to the continent, we have resisted the genocidal conditions that the Europeans have tried to bring to our continent and to ourselves as people, right? But we were enslaved in the South through settler colonialism. They brought us as people, as a colony, as a nation of people, as different nations of people, to a colony in the South, and there we have the plantation. So if we want to understand the foundation of American capitalism, if we want to understand the foundation of American settler colonialism, if we want to understand the foundation of American racism, it goes back to settler colonialism and the slave trade and slavery, right? Through slavery, America has become the biggest purveyor of violence. They not only enacted violence on the plantation, but they subjugated us to the economic rule of that, right? Which, what does that mean? That means that our bodies was the biggest amount of capital. Our bodies, before the so-called dollar even existed, our bodies is what existed as capital, right? So the value of slaves was roughly 3 times greater than the total amount invested in banks, and it was equal to about 7 times the total values of all currency in circulation in the country. 3 times the value of the entire livestock population, 12 times the value of the entire U.S. cotton crop, right? And 48 times the total expenditure of the federal government that year. Our bodies. People talk about the New York Stock Exchange. We were the first people traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Not stock, we were the stock. Our bodies was a stock. Our people was a stock. Our languages was a stock. Forcing us to do the labor of this country, to expand this country, right? To expand it to what we know as the so-called 50 United States of America. Banks such as Wells Fargo owned slaves. Owned slaves as collateral. The foundation of this banking system in America goes back to the enslavement of our people, where these lazy Europeans didn't work and forced us to work through subjugation of the most crimes. These are some of the biggest crimes against humanity, and it must be understood as such. This is the foundation of the economy, and we must understand that the foundation of this economy was our lives, where cotton was the leading American export from 1803 to 1937. What we were forced to pick, cotton, the leading American export. What does that mean? Now this country is getting rich, is getting wealthy, developing the wealth to then now have more advanced weapons because they enslaved us. They exterminated, they made attempts to exterminate the indigenous people, and they forced Africans through slavery to produce the economics of this country. All this wealth now is used to fund imperialism and to strengthen the military. So if we understand settler colonialism in America, we understand that also Israel, the regime of Israel, has no right to exist. The regime of Israel has no right to exist. It in itself is another settler colony, right? That's why when we connect these dots between what's going on here in America and what's going on in the legal Zionist Israeli occupation, we see that the Americans, right, the Euro-Americans, the colonizers, the slave owners, right, they're the ones helping fund the Iron Dome. It was by no mistake, right? So we connect these issues with the issues of freeing Palestine to freeing the land here from Euro-American control. So my name is Abbas Muntakeem. Hopefully y'all got a better understanding of what settler colonialism is. And the next episode, we're going to talk some more. So this is Power to the People. I'm Abbas Muntakeem. Tap into the next episode.
Thank you, Abbas, and thank you, viewers, for watching the program. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure you tune in next week when we come back with another episode of We the People. Thanks for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you,
A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to your program Like Muhammad with me, Javed Akbari. In this episode, I'm going to speak about forgiveness from the perspective of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. Forgiving is a great, to be able to forgive other people is a great moral trait. In fact, the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, was a figure who was known for being kind and very much forgiving. Compared to what we have to face today, the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, had to endure greater trials and tribulations from the Almighty. The people of Quraysh, there are reports which say that the people of Quraysh spat at the Prophet, heard him, and threw dirt at him when he was returning home from the mosque after performing his prayers. But the Prophet never responded to their ill behavior or to their misconduct. There are different incidents. It has been reported that the Prophet went to Taif, and an incident took place in Taif when the Prophet tried to preach the word of God among the people in Taif. The people there refused to accept his invitation. Of course, the locals and the young people, the young men of Taif, they were called Saqif tribe or Saqif clan, threw stones at him. They threw camel dirt at the Prophet, and they caused him injury. And so the Prophet suffered a lot when he was in Taif. But the Prophet still prayed that the people would be forgiven by Allah, even though the archangel Gabriel offered to destroy the people of Taif. But the Prophet of forgiveness, the Prophet of Rahmah, prayed that those people be forgiven and that Allah shower his mercy upon those people to guide them in the right path. The approach taken by the Prophet was to forgive and pray for the well-being of the people. He never cursed the people, even though they were not good at him, even though they were mean towards the Prophet, since he was the Prophet of Rahmah, and he was mercy to the worlds. He prayed for their forgiveness and prayed for their well-being. The act of hurting others, being, you know, temperamental and harboring hate and vengeance towards others, will disrupt one's physical health and even increase blood pressure. Let's have a short break, dear brothers and sisters, and of course we will come back with the continuation of the story.
وحشنا
Welcome back. This is Laik Muhammad from IRIB English Radio. We talked about forgiveness from the perspective of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. Hate is something that you can harbor, but it's a kind of illness. It actually endangers your physical well-being. It affects the person's life more than it affects other people in the neighborhood. Now, the noble virtues of forgiveness practiced by the Prophet, peace be upon him, should be an example followed by mankind. You know, if someone came to seek forgiveness, the Prophet would immediately forgive that person. It takes a lot to forgive a person, as it requires a big heart and a kind soul, actually. It requires broad-mindedness. A person who forgives is considered to be very noble as well. There are few people who can forgive, but forgiveness is one of the best qualities that a person can have in his life. The act of forgiveness must be practiced anytime and anywhere. No human being is free from making mistakes. Therefore, there shouldn't be any reason to shy away from asking for forgiveness. We should never feel that forgiving someone is a burden for forgiveness, because forgiveness is deemed a truly noble act in the eyes of Almighty Allah. There is a verse in the Holy Quran which says, وَسَارِعُوا إِلَىٰ مَغْفِرَةٍ مِّن رَبِّكُمْ. Okay? Now, سَارِعُوا إِلَىٰ مَغْفِرَةٍ مِّن رَبِّكُمْ means that you have to hasten towards God's forgiveness. You have to make haste. The religion of Islam is a religion of competition. It is like a race. Everyone should race towards forgiveness. Everyone should race towards mercy of Allah. Everyone should race towards achieving more proximity to Allah. That's what sari'u means. Everyone should excel other people. If you are forgiving, you should forgive others more than other people. And if you are generous, you should be more generous than other people. This is what the religion of Islam is. It's not, you know, the religion of Islam is not like staying quiet somewhere and doing nothing, of course, being very much, down to earth and keeping your eyes closed. That's not at all. That's not what Islam is about. So Islam is about competitiveness, about being in competition with other people. And that's what sari'u means. Sari'u means making haste towards forgiveness. There is, of course, someone else who competes with you in the religion. So if you want to excel him, you should also make haste, and you have to, of course, race, and you have to make haste towards God forgiveness, towards generosity and being merciful. And you have to make haste towards achieving more proximity to Allah. We will come back with the continuation of the program, like Muhammad. It is related from the Prophet, peace be upon him, that he said, on the day of resurrection, a herald will call out, whoever's reward is with God, then let him enter paradise. It will be asked, whose reward is with God? It will be answered, those who forgive the people, for they will enter paradise without being held to account. And there are more traditions to come about forgiveness, about being kind, about being merciful. I would like to request dear brothers and sisters to read the Prophet's traditions in the books authored by prominent Shia scholars for themselves. Of course, there are many books written by Shia authors, and these books are available on the internet. I want you to go through those books and improve your knowledge, improve your understanding of religious teachings, of morality, of akhlaq, akhlaq according to the Prophet. And I pray that you are successful. Inshallah, may Allah grant you success. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave. Shafi'ullah, Habibullah, Nabiullah, Rasulullah, Khalilullah, the friend of Allah, Ya Rasulullah,
is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Washington, whose hegemony is on the wane because of backlash of world countries towards its tyranny and long list of crimes against humanity, cannot prevent Beijing from either working towards a One Korea policy and a Chinese umbrella covering East Southeast Asia, or expanding trade and industrial ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran and the West Asian countries, as well as African states, with the markets of Europe and even Latin America now flooded with Chinese goods. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kehan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, "Xi Outclasses Biden in Virtual Summit." Stay tuned for more.
The recent video summit between the presidents of the world's two largest economies centered largely on rhetoric in which the aging Joe Biden was simply outclassed by the energetic Xi Jinping. China's chief executive drew red lines and spoke of decisive action by Beijing for any move by the breakaway island of Taiwan towards independence, while his U.S. counterpart, who is accused of encouraging the secessionists through arms supplies, considered that Washington adheres to the One China policy. It was clear that the Americans, despite attempts of flexing their aging and aching military muscles in the South China Sea, weren't looking for any confrontation with the rapidly growing might of China. In this age of nuclear warheads and intercontinental ballistic missiles, a war is disastrous for not just the two antagonists, but for the rest of the world, and thus reason dictates that it should be avoided at all costs. Insane and illegitimate regimes such as Israel, fearful of their impending end, threaten war and crave for war, which will only accelerate their doom. Moreover, neither the U.S. nor China will ever enter into proxy wars with each other, no matter how strongly Beijing were to denounce any American military move in a third country, or how vehemently Washington were to condemn Chinese intrusions in any neighboring state. The U.S. and China thus are more concerned about how to outmaneuver each other in the trade war in a bid to boost their respective economies rather than boast about their doomsday stockpiles. Both believe that diplomacy is the only viable way to deal with each other. As Xi displayed in the virtual summit by smilingly calling Biden my old friend, while his American counterpart never allowed his tone to become tense and was as courteous as possible. The Americans believe that cutting American tariffs on Chinese imports could reduce inflation, the biggest economic and political headache for the Biden regime. Since, as of October, the U.S. is importing Chinese goods at an annual rate of $600 billion, a 60% increase from the pre-COVID-19 level of October 2018. In other words, trade between the two countries is so extensive that it has a major influence on the U.S. price level, which means it is odd to speak of a Cold War between the U.S. and China when the American industrial economy is massively dependent on Chinese imports. China very well understands the U.S. weakness and is confident that with its vast resources, cheap labor, giant strides in modern technology and its policy of the Roads and Belt Initiative, or BRI, it can surge ahead of its main rival in the long run. All this means Washington, whose hegemony is on the wane because of the backlash of world countries towards its tyranny and long list of crimes against humanity, cannot prevent Beijing from either working towards a One Korea policy and a Chinese umbrella covering East Southeast Asia, or expanding trade and industrial ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran and the West Asian countries, as well as African states, with the markets of Europe and even Latin America now flooded with Chinese goods.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, being religious. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of being religious. What does it mean and what effects does it have in our lifestyle when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle? Does being religious an important thing or not? Or can someone who's not religious have or adopt the Islamic lifestyle and reach to perfection? Now, one thing which we need to bear in our minds that when we are talking about the lifestyle and especially Islamic lifestyle, it is to take us, this lifestyle will take us towards the perfection, which is known as sa'adat in Arabic. So the word sa'adat in Arabic means that you reach to perfection, you have a good life in this world and a good ending in hereafter. This does not mean that you are suffering in this life, in this world, in order to get a better life in hereafter. No. Sa'adat or success or perfection means that you had a good life, a successful life in this world, and you have a good and successful life in hereafter. So when we talk about the lifestyle and we talk about being religious, it does not mean that a person who does not follow religion, who is not religious, can reach to perfection. Now, why do we say so? It is because that being religious is being negatively translated or defined in the general life in the West, especially. You know, in the West, they say like the being religious means you're so much conservative and you just do what you think and what religion says. You do not enjoy your life. You do not communicate with people so much because you're religious. And being religious means that you live alone and you do not socialize.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of being religious, and we said generally in the West, or generally people, they think like being religious means that you live alone, you do not socialize in people, you're very conservative, and you do not socialize in a way that the others do, and you do not even enjoy your life. You do not have any entertainment or enjoyment in your life. This is a concept that is generally given for a person who is being religious. Now, let's look at the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the Islamic lifestyle and the being religious in Islam, what does it mean? It means that you do not disobey Allah Almighty, and that's it. This is the simplest definition of being religious. Being religious means that you do not disobey Allah Almighty. For example, if Allah has forbidden the alcohol, then you do not go towards alcohol. If Allah has forbidden the mixed gathering marriages or the places where there's a mixed gathering, the mixed gathering itself is not a bad thing. But the problem is if you see people are dressed in a way which is forbidden, or if they are not basically having the veils and the the place where you're going, it's not suitable for you, then obviously you avoid such things. So this is what it means, actually, being religious, that you do not disobey Allah. If Allah has said to eat halal, you go for halal foods only. You do not go for haram. But it does not mean that you do not enjoy your life. You enjoy through the halal means. That's what it means, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We cannot rely on the U.S. or its allies to champion democracy around the world, said Global Grassroots Movement Progressive International. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. and its allies are fueling worldwide erosion of democracy, analysis shows. Stay tuned for more. Recent internal attacks on democracy and human rights by the United States and many of its allies, which often portray themselves as exporters of such ideals, are driving an overall erosion of democracy worldwide, according to a new analysis. The New York Times analyzed an annual report released earlier this year by VDEM, a Swedish research institute that collects data on democracy and autocratic governments around the world, finding that the United States and several of the countries it's considered allies in recent decades have shifted substantially away from operating as democracies, with attacks on voting rights, judicial independence, and the rights of the media among the factors driving the erosion. Much of the world's backsliding is not imposed on democracies by foreign powers, but rather is a rot rising within the world's most powerful network of mostly democratic alliances. The U.S. and its allies drove increases in democracy scores, according to VDEM's reporting, throughout 1990.